It's Saturday, February 16th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9. You're listening to Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. Today, throughout the program, we'll be taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. You can ask us anything you'd like. I'd love to have your calls and questions about technology. It's always fun to try to figure out what the problem is or to hear your opinions about how technology is affecting you. The phone number is 800-655-5877. Again, that's 800-655-5877. And I'll give out that number a few times if you didn't get it. Good morning, Bonnie Jean Primsch.
Oh, Lyle Troxell, how are you doing?
Quite well. Thank you so much for doing last week's show. It was fantastic.
I'm glad I got through that. It was the first time sitting behind that board, like doing a live show, operating the board, since my radio show went off the air in the afternoons, which was, years and years ago.
Yeah, it's been years. And the board's all new.
It's a new board. It's a different board now.
I'm so glad we prepared so well. No, you did amazingly well. Or at least I only heard the recorded version, which was nice and edited.
I managed to edit out my big club halfway through the show.
Well, we have had quite a morning. First of all, let me just introduce. My name is Lyle Troxell. I host Geek Speak have been doing so for 12 years or so. And in the air with me is Bonnie Jean Primsch, broadcaster at large, mediator, and printmaker.
Yeah,
definitely.
Those are things that I do.
That's true.
Yeah.
And last week's show was fantastic. I was in Paris. And I got to say, I finally figured out something about time travel. I should say space travel in this day and age.
Really?
I know it seems a little abstract that I'm using those terms, but traveling across the planet, of course, you shift your hours, right?
Oh, like you're talking about going through the time zones.
Yes, and living in Paris for a week and then coming back. And I finally got something this week on Thursday. I got back on Sunday. And Thursday, I seemed to be really tired and having a lot of trouble. And I said, I think something's wrong with me. And my partner said, yes, that's why it's called jet lag. Because it actually affects you a few days later. And I didn't really get... And I went, oh, that's the meaning of that word. I really, really did not get that it did not affect you immediately. It affected you over time.
Later.
Yeah.
Because of the huge jump in
yes.
time. You know, my mom has a cure for jet lag.
It
involves
what is it?
Preparation.
Sleeping?
Yeah. You know what she does is if she knows she's taking off for a trip, she adjusts her sleep schedule by 1 hour every night leading up to the time she's going to travel. So by the day she travels, she's on her destination's time schedule.
So you're suggesting that I prepare to go to Paris 9 days. I don't think I knew I was going.
I'm going to say something, Lyle. Preparation in general can be very handy.
I think you're referring to what we did today.
Okay, guys. We had a situation today where Lyle and I sort of waltz in, you know.
As we do.
As we do sometime before the show.
Yes.
And then we prepare. And the network wasn't up here in the station, and we realized we were little helpless babies.
Yes.
Couldn't do a thing without network access. We're just blind.
And it wasn't even like we got that we didn't have network access and we'd have to deal with that and we moved on. Yeah. It was 20 minutes of us going, what do we do?
I'm going to push the button again.
The trouble with troubleshooting is you need time to do it. And when you don't have time, when you're on air in a few minutes and you're not prepared at all. So it might sound like we're not prepared, but in reality, since we're such radio experts.
We got this, you guys.
We got it.
Just
now,
relax. You'll be fine.
It also helps that the network came back. We figured it out.
Yeah. And that we'll be able to take your calls.
So speaking of unpreparedness, or more like, let's speak about time travel. Because this is a theme.
The jet lag thing.
Yeah. No, I'm done with the jet lag thing.
Are
but that
done?
Reminds me of a conversation you had through email with Ben Jaffe. Don't ruin your computer by.
I am a spit took. Is that the past tense of spit take?
I think so.
I almost just
you literally had coffee in your mouth, though. That could have been bad for your laptop, which finally has a network connection.
All right, so you know what happened? Let me just explain.
Yes.
And we'll have a link to this, right?
Oh, yeah.
At the show site.
So eventually.
At some time in the last couple of weeks, this video was circulating of the guys from Bare Naked Ladies and a sort of like a youthful, enthusiastic chorus singing along with an astronaut Chris Hadfield, they were singing a duet. He was in space playing the guitar.
In the International Space Station.
In the International Space Station, playing guitar and singing a song that he and the guy from Bare Naked Ladies co-wrote together.
Yes.
And they were performing it together. And I was that's so beautiful.
Bare Naked Ladies was on the planet.
Yeah, they were on the planet. So was the chorus.
Okay.
And they were singing to like a video monitor of Chris Hadfield, the astronaut, singing live from the International Space Station. And I was very moved. I had the tears. And then I thought, wait a minute, what about space lag? Like all the time, like we're so used to watching like interviews with astronauts and, you know, people on the ground will ask a question and then grin for a few minutes while the astronaut receives the question, because it takes time for things to get to space. And then they answer the question. Then there's a lag before it gets back to the ground. And that wasn't happening. They were singing in perfect sync and I did not understand it. So I said, hey, Ben.
Or he actually said, hey, geeks. Yeah.
Yeah. Geeks in general, aside from being super moving, this amazes me because what about delay? How come they were so well synced? What happened to that awkward pause that happens? That's my question. And then Ben came back.
Shall I read for Ben?
Yeah.
Okay. To be clear, I hadn't read this until earlier today.
Okay.
Because I wanted to do the research. Ben decided that he did the research. But yeah. This is, okay, here's his response. Oh, man, that was so cool. We all should talk about it. Chris played along with a previously made recording. Then the musicians played with his track. It was most likely synced up to a MIDI time code and or a click track to ensure everybody stayed perfectly on beat. Basically, Chris didn't hear the Earthlings singing live. He heard a recording of them. Also, really great show last week. Just listen to it. And man, you got great radio talent. Nice show, Ben. And I agree, you do.
Thank you. That was not a relevant part of the email.
Sorry about that.
And so then I wrote back to Ben and I said, thanks, Ben. And well, I'm a little sad to find out they weren't playing live with each other. That's somewhat less awesome. But to be clear, isn't it that the musicians played along with the recording of the astronaut and not the reverse? It is. I'm smart.
No. The astronaut was live. He was playing with a previously made recording. And the people on the ground were playing along with his feed. So they were playing live, but technically speaking, the astronaut was actually a bit ahead of him.
So then I said, I see. So you hid the answer to my question in some techie gobbledygook.
Yes.
What is a MIDI time code and a click track? What are those things?
Click track is a fancy term for metronome. And MIDI time code is a synchronized clock that instruments or a click track can synchronize to, Ben.
And that was the end of our communication. And I'm still, Lyle, confused about what happened there.
And I'm listening to, I'm reading this. this morning and just was tears in my eyes because he was answering perfectly what was going on and you were hearing his words and no meaning was transposed.
I really do feel like perhaps
right.
On this show I'm going to be the bridge between geeks and the rest of
Let's
humanity
do
Lyle,
this.
Because I
Let's
don't
do
get thing. It all right so how was a MIDI track
okay so that what? Was that was a red herring. It's not necessary at all to talk about this,
okay.
But I will talk about MIDI time code
okay.
and sync. But first off, let's just describe how this actually worked.
Right.
So yes, there's going to be a problem with the International Space Station and Earth and how much time it takes for communications to occur. It probably, in the perfect of situations, could be really fast, almost so that you wouldn't even notice. But it's orbiting the Earth, and therefore it's changing its location all the time, and to actually communicate with it is pretty complicated. So there's a delay. There's always a delay.
It's just going to be a delay, and there is.
That's how we do it.
So I think what Ben was talking about is accounting for that delay
yes.
and kind of anticipating it.
Yes. And there's two ways to do it. One is you could technically have musicians that could be off from each other, but live, a measure of time. And then you're not actually playing the same song or hearing the same thing. So if I start playing, mm-hmm. and when you hear me a measure later, but we both start at the same time, we would be out of sync. So like if we did... you've heard people sing songs like this where I'd start a song and then a measure later you'd start the song.
It's called a round.
Yeah, and we could sing together. You know, like the Row, Row, Your Boat is a perfect example of that. When I go to the second verse of it, you could start the first and it would sound okay.
Right.
So if you both did that, theoretically you could sing together, but you wouldn't really hear each other.
If you had a measure, if you had a round line that had the exact same amount of time as the delay from space.
And they technically could, what they could do is they could take the delaying system and sync that to the music and do it that way. Now there's some online music playing systems that do this, and it's a very effective way of jamming with people.
That's been happening on the planet.
On the planet for a while, right?
Performing with each other.
And I've run into this kind of situation with live performance stuff. We did a multi coastal dance performance that was like this, where dancers were on the East Coast and on the West Coast. It was produced by Ted Warburton here in the U.S. at UCSC. Uh-huh. And Dance Telematica was the name of the piece. And the way we compensated for that is that there was a bit of a delay, and that's okay.
Right.
So you don't really notice.
Art, whatever. Yeah.
But the space delay is too much. I love that we're calling it space delay, by the way.
Space delay.
So this is what you do. You want to have the effect on the Earth that you're singing live with a musician on the space station.
Because that's where most of the people are who will be watching.
But everything they're going to do on the space station is going to be delayed. So if they start playing at the space station and you start playing live with them and broadcast them in the room, then it feels to the people on the planet everything's cool. Unless you ask for something from the space, you know, something different. So imagine what was really happening.
That makes sense if the only people sort of like receiving everything are the folks on Earth.
Yes.
And if Chris Hadfield is trying to sing along to them at the same time,
that's
then it
the
could
part
get
that's
potentially
tricky.
Very fargly.
So what they did, what Ben is suggesting they did, is the piece was played on the Earth without cameras on.
Okay.
Their side of it. That piece was recorded and uploaded to him.
Okay.
He then started playing that piece and heard that, but did not broadcast that, and then played along with it. So he's playing with recording of the people from Earth, a previous recording that's not something we saw.
Okay, so he was some sort of like a keep himself on time track pre-recorded that he was playing along to. So he was responding to that piece of music.
Right.
Let me see if I've got this.
Yes,
loud.
Please.
And then, so that goes down to the planet. And Chris had, or the Bare-Naked Ladies guy, whose name I can't remember, and the enthusiastic chorus are sort of seeing the feed of him singing, and it just looks like he's singing. And so then they sing to the monitor, and so it's sort of like an illusion. They weren't really singing at the same time.
But here's the point that Ben is very cleverly sticking in there.
Yeah.
Even though we're hearing a delay from Chris on the space station, he's not recorded. Because it takes a while for the sound to go.
What do you mean he's not recorded?
So he's playing along with the recording live. That stream is going live to the planet.
Oh, I see.
It takes
he's
a while
a,
to get there.
He's a live
there.
Person doing that.
It takes a while to get there. And when it's played on this in the environment where everybody is, it's not actually recording. It's him playing live. Mm-hmm. It just happens to be delayed.
Yeah.
To mess with everybody's minds, you and I, Bonnie, are in the future compared to when the audience is hearing us. We actually have a system right next to me, an 8-second delay that does the same thing.
Yeah.
We are live, but we're actually, so that's why the reason why Ben said they're in the future, he's leading ahead of them, because he's playing and there's a delay for us to get it. And therefore he's actually singing the song ahead of us.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
He sings it first and then we catch up.
And that's why, of course, he needed a pre-recording to play along with.
Right.
Now, these are professional musicians. They did a good job of all playing together.
Yeah.
And they did play with a live version of him, just delayed.
Right. So why would you need a metronome? Because they've got Chris to sing
and
along
and
to.
You don't. And that's why I said it's kind of a red herring, right?
Okay.
Because they could technically just play along with him. But the thing that's interesting is that he's not the drummer and he's not the bassist.
Uh-huh.
And normally one of those musicians would actually start the song.
Oh, right.
And everyone would get time to them.
Uh-huh.
So if it's just him singing, how do they determine when to start? Because he's singing and playing guitar. When does he get to start? And that was the trouble. So there has to be something to say, we're starting. Somewhere in that space was music from the International Space Station that was a bit of information about the song when it started. And when the people on the planet heard that part of it or were told that's starting, that's when they started playing along. So everything synced up. That's a time code.
Wouldn't that be the same as you and I are jamming around the campfire and you play the first four bars on the guitar?
Right.
And
or
then we all know to
or
jump
rock
in.
Musicians normally take their sticks, right, and they go...
Right.
That's the time code of the song.
Yeah. Those were drumsticks, by the way.
Yeah,
not pencils.
Right. Not pencils. I would never have pencil in their room.
No. Yeah.
So exactly. So what we don't need the terminology time code or MIDI time code or MIDI sync. Those are technical ways of solving this problem that are really necessary when you do a lot of electronic music.
But
in this situation, we just know that we need the people that are on the Earth to start the song in the same sync as the person on the space station.
Okay. Understood.
Now,
anyway,
I could get
awesome.
Into MIDI and time sync code stuff, but I don't think it's necessary.
No, okay. Thank you.
It was awesome, right?
Let's spare everybody. And you guys should check it out, and we'll have it up at geekspeak.org because it was quite a moving little performance. I
agree. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Bonnie Jean Primsch. In the other room, we have Rick. And Rick is waiting for your calls with questions and comments of technology. We'll ask anything today.
But what's the number?
Oh, you want to say it?
I'm going to see if I can remember it. 1-800-655-5877. That's the number to call.
And you are listening to KUSP. Okay, Bonnie.
Yeah.
So we're talking about, you know, live music versus not. And at some point in the stream, you mentioned something that's just totally in line with something that Steve Laufer just sent me. Now, Steve's the webmaster here at the station, and yeah. He listens to the show at his house, which means he's listening to a delay of it.
Uh-huh.
But he sent in a question live, and he says, it's funny how we like it a little bit less, knowing it's not exactly live, so why do we like it less? And I ask you that, Bonnie. Why does it matter to you that it's not as awesome live?
Because there's less tinglies involved, right? It's less miraculous. There's less sort of like, it's less perfect somehow. It's cheatery.
These that are was all... so scientific and geeky of you. Cheatery, Steve. Cheatery.
It's too cheatery. Well, and I wonder if we blew it for a bunch of listeners, letting them know that we're actually on an 8-second delay.
Well, so this is the thing that's so interesting about delay and time and such. We actually never have absolute now. That concept of now doesn't really exist. It's in our language.
Now, it's already passed.
Exactly. In our language. Man. And actually, technically, when I say now, even though you're in the same room with me, only 4 feet apart from me,
yeah.
Sorry, I'm a meter and a little bit, it is delayed.
You're getting so Euro now that you're taking off the Paris all the time.
There is a little bit of a delay. I mean, all mediums have delay.
Yeah.
And we ignore that delay, except for when it becomes great. And you only know when it's great when you get a feedback loop. When I say something and then you say something. We've had this experience with using Skype or some delayed phone system where it's really frustrating. It's one of the reasons why I try not to do Skype on the radio, because we get these delay things where it's not really like a conversation. Yeah. So I think the reason why we downplay the idea of recording is that we know when we're at a real experience versus having a recording of an experience. Going to see, what was the name of the band?
Bare Naked Ladies.
Going to see Bare Naked Ladies live in concert, that you're there. You are all these people and you're experiencing every single bit of it. Right. And that experience is not just an oral one. It is a smell and tactile and environmental and a night leading up to it in a way. So having that experience we know is more rich than throwing the CD in. But I think what we've done in our society is we have merged live with all this extra stuff and recording with less than. And that's why I think that's why we have a judgment on it, I believe.
Well, right. Isn't that why everyone was so upset when Milli Vanilli, it turns out they were lip syncing? It wasn't a real performance, right?
Right.
That was the criticism of Beyoncé. Oh, was that a real performance? Because she had a backup track.
Yeah.
It wasn't a completely live experience.
I have a friend of mine who is a musician, and he has a band that actually, he plays every single instrument in the band. Uh-huh. And he does that by audio recording. There's a lot of musicians doing this now, right?
It's a thing.
He cannot perform live. It is not physically possible. He can't perform drums and keys. And, you know, he can't do all that at the same time.
Yeah.
So he has to play with himself recorded. So what does a performance of his look like? Which instrument does he decide to do live? Which instrument does he... Is it the singing that he decides to do live? Why would it be the singing and not the guitar? And so, to me, it becomes a... It much more becomes a question of our experience in a technology world and how what judgment calls we make on that.
Right.
So, the trick about radio, of course, is what are you losing by... by recording it and playing it again. I would argue you're not losing anything. In fact, almost all the content we hear on the radio has some recorded qualities to it, right? I mean, some of the great shows that we listen to are actually extremely edited shows, as you and I know as radio people, right? And I do like the live dynamicness of it.
Yeah, and they're different things, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, the advantage, we're getting too involved in this, by the way.
We are, and we should move on.
Let's move on. You guys chew on that further if you're interested.
The phone number is 1-800-655-5877 if you'd like to ask us questions.
My computer is now logging off without my consent, so I'm gonna be technically saddled by not having my little technology teat to suckle on here. Hey, speaking of syncing, though, isn't there something with BitTorrent and syncing going on these days? What's that all about?
Okay, talk about another long topic. This is great. So BitTorrent has gotten a bad name, but the general concept is traditionally when you download a file, you have to go to a website and they're an authoritative person like Microsoft.com or Apple.com, right? Mm-hmm. And you download a file from them. They're giving you every bit of what that file is to your computer. Mm-hmm. And it takes a while. And it also has a lot of load to that company. So if you and I have a very popular thing we want to share with the world, we have to put it up somewhere. And in a traditional way, the sender of that data, that the person that downloads it, has to take on that response with the bandwidth.
And if a lot of people are doing it once, then it's lots drag of and it takes slower for everyone.
That's
is that
right.
True?
That's okay. True. So when BitTorrent was first released, we'd covered it on GeekSpeak. You can look at our archives online. And in fact, all the audio files of the archives of our website is actually on a server of mine. So if it gets hit too hard, I'm in trouble.
Okay.
We should move to BitTorrent. BitTorrent allows you to, the general idea is, if you download a file and I want to download a file at the same time, we both start downloading different bits of it from that original place. I get part number two and you get part number one. You're done with part number one. You need part number two still. I'm done with part number two and I need part number one. Uh-huh. I can download part number one from you and you can download part number two from me.
And that's faster because it's less load on BitTorrent.
On the right. On the site that you actually originated from.
Yeah.
It only had to download the part one and part two, each of them once, even though we both got a copy. So what happens is when you have, let's say, 1,000 people downloading a file,
yeah,
and that's 1,000 bits down, everything only has to be downloaded from each person kind of once, uh-huh, and everyone can share from each other.
So is this a little bit like that program where all of the computers together are searching space for intelligent life, and everyone's kind of working on pieces of the problem?
In the distributed processing problem, it is similar.
Okay.
It is this idea that the problem is complicated. If you do it in one big chunk, we can break it up. And this is just distributing content in a broken up fashion.
Got it. Okay.
Okay.
Is that syncing?
No. So that is BitTorrent. And BitTorrent is awesome for downloading large files. It happens to be extremely fast. And one of the reasons is, if you are on a local network, let's say in Santa Cruz, and you happen to be with Cruz.io, Cruz.io's network is actually, to some degree, faster internally than going to the outside internet. So we're downloading something from China. And we only download it once from China. And by the time it gets to us, all the people are downloading have little bits. And you and I, because we live in the same subnet, mm-hmm, not really, but in the same area, you and I can download a lot faster from each other.
Okay.
So it speeds things up as well.
Got it. Okay. Understood.
Now, syncing. Everyone understands the idea of syncing. You have a file on your one place and you want the same copy somewhere else. BitTorrent's releasing this new package that's called BitTorrent Sync. It's not completely released yet, but it's awesome. And this is the general idea. You and I can set up a folder amongst each other, uh-huh, that we'll put things in and it will show up on each other's folders. So BitTorrent will actually sync between our computers' information. This is very much like Dropbox. Have you ever used Dropbox?
I have used Dropbox.
Yeah. It's like Dropbox, but
people use Dropbox.
Yes. You want to explain what Dropbox is?
Dropbox is a place where you can put large files so
on
that
computer.
Other people can pick them up.
Yeah.
So you can go from your computer to a site, mm-hmm, out there called Dropbox, and then Dropbox says, we got this, we'll hold this for the person you want to have it.
Yeah.
And either they contact person or you contact person.
Yeah.
They contact person. And go, hey, we've got this thing for you. And then you can say, oh, I'm going to go pick that up at my leisure.
It's kind of like downloading attachments through email, except that instead of it being sent to you, a link is sent to you. And then you go, and the thing that they've built in that's really nice is they actually say, you know what we'll do is if you have files that are for you and you have an account with us, you install this application on your computer and we'll make all the files that we have for you on your computer all the time, syncing automatically. So the folder on your desktop, if you put something in it from one computer and you have the same account, it gets added to both computers.
Right.
And that's what I'm calling sync.
Okay.
It's kind of like that. So BitTorrent does the same service, is going to have the same service, but without some company in the way, in the middle of it. Instead, it will be democratized in the sense that if I make a folder and I share the link with you,
yeah,
you will use BitTorrent behind the scenes to sync all the data in my folder to your folder. So if you and I are working on a project together,
right,
we do this to its folders. I add something in the file folder, you get a copy, and vice versa, automatically syncing content. The additional benefit, if you have multiple computers, is that it acts as a sort of backup. So if you started using all your personal files in a synced folder, mm-hmm, over time, you've got a copy on your, let's say, your desktop and your laptop, and maybe you've also shared it with a friend because you're collaborating. If any one of those hard drives dies, the data is still safe.
And so that's the whole Google Drive thing, too.
It's kind of like Google Drive.
Okay.
The reason why BitTorrent doing it is so wonderful is that with Google Drive, with Dropbox, with 100 other services like this, they are the authority. They have your files. They determine. And that they is a corporation.
Wait, why is that great? I just got the chills.
That's the creepy part.
Okay.
We're putting all this personal data. We want it safe and secure, but we're trusting a corporation to do that.
Yeah.
With this BitTorrent sync, we will not have to have a middleman. You and I could decide to have a democratized folder between each other, and the only people that have it are you and I.
And how do they not have it also?
Because they're not actually sending the data to them. We are using them to communicate where our data is so we can talk to each other and have the data transferred.
Oh, I see. So it never goes.
It's for the people and of the people, exactly. Ooh. And it will be extremely fun to use this service to copy large files that we want to share together.
Oh, I am making a note of this BitTorrent syncing thing.
So when BitTorrent sync is out and about, I will talk about it more. And I'll also link to the article, of course, on geekspeak.org. That's called BitTorrent sync. And BitTorrent, the group, is doing some awesome things. I believe they're a nonprofit. And they're open source and kind of heroes.
Swell on toast.
We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. You can ask us anything you'd like to your heart's desire. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. My name is Lyle Troxell, and in the air with me is Bonnie Jean Primch.
You know, Lyle, we did get an email while you and I were talking.
Please.
From a fellow by the name of John to the geeks in general. And I wonder if you wanted it answered on the air, but I'm willing to ask it on the air for you, John. I hope you don't mind. It says, I'm interested in making or acquiring a music server computer to house my music library. After several Google searches, I came up with a machine at a website, and he offered us a link to a thing at computeraudiofile.com. And he has a couple of questions about it. So while you're looking that up, Lyle, I'm just going to voice the questions.
Okay, please.
The first is that they're using a 32-bit Windows 7 program. And he's wondering, why not the 64-bit version? That just seems like it might be better for, you know, more is better. It is actually cheaper when one buys it, and it seems like more bits would be better. They say that this particular motherboard CPU combo can only use the 32-bit version. Could a different combo work better with the 64-bit version? So it sounds like he's understanding that they're sort of working with their own limitations, and he's questioning if that's a real limitation. So that's one question.
Okay.
He's also interested that they're using an SSD drive, which you can explain what that is. I don't know what that is.
Oh, good. Something I can answer now.
Yeah. He understands that they're much faster, but they do not have as much storage capacity, and he's wondering if that's a problem. And he said the music will be stored on a NAS, which is another thing.
Yes.
So I don't know if this is too technical to sort of answer extemporaneously over there, but thank you for the question.
That was a great question.
So what is this thing?
Isn't it funny when people say it's a great question, meaning I don't have the answer for it? That's what
they
actually mean when it's a great question.
It's great as in awesome, as in I'm boggled.
Yeah.
All right, so computeraudiofile.com.
Yes.
What is
okay,
this
so first off, computeraudiofile.com is just a collection of people that want to figure out what the best way to deal with music, their music collection is.
Okay, so they talk to each other about it.
Sure.
Okay.
And there's some articles and reviews of types of hardware you can get and software you can use.
So this one's about Pocket Server CPS version 3.
Right. And this is just a hardware box that allows you to deal with your music library. It's a computer. Okay. It's a computer that's specifically designed to be a music server, which means that probably it doesn't have a loud fan. It's nice and quiet. It doesn't use a lot of power consumption. You can have it on all the time.
Okay. And yet it's there for recording music. Why 32 bits versus 64 bits? That's
would you did you try, did you hear that about recording music versus so I'm sorry. What's the question that you're interested in?
Well, he's saying that how weird, like here's this thing that's designed for dealing with music, but it's 32 bit. Why not 64 bit? You get more music information and you get just a better recording.
So when you're dealing with the highest end computer, you want all the features and bells and whistles. You want it to be amazingly fast and wonderful.
Right.
Doing the most up-to-date things makes a lot of sense because you are pushing the envelope. But when you want a device that functions a certain way and you want that reliability and you want that benefits I mentioned, quiet, and you want it to be low power, pushing the envelope in every single direction isn't actually necessary. What you want to do is you want to make sure you have a really good music player, right? Because that's the goal. So my refrigerator has a computer in it. It's a very minimal computer. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's really a minimal computer is it only needs to do like four or five things. It needs to deal with temperature and keep the fans running and decide if it's going to make ice or not. Right?
It's got a specific function.
Yeah. And therefore, I don't need a quad-core Intel processor in there.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. You don't need the fancy turbo, blah, blah, blah.
What we found in the last 10 years or so, and more closely, more recently, is that we have really powerful hardware. And we really rarely need that powerful hardware. And yet, everything we do is based around that. And you'll see a few years ago, you know, these light computers came out, the smaller, lighter computers that aren't as powerful, but you're more likely to use them.
That you really do.
Yeah.
Right.
So playing music, is not hard. In fact, the way everything is played here at the station mm-hmm. is by hardware that that plays music files, and there's not high-end processors in them. It's right. relatively simple processors.
So it sounds like you're saying that this is this thing, this pocket server, blah, 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 is mostly for playing music, not for recording
music? I think that he's talking about playing music, and I have to say that I didn't read it.
And he doesn't say one way or the other, really.
Right. And so let's assume that it's about playing music. And if it's about playing music, recording music too. You want the thing that runs well, that has no hiccups. That's what you want. You want okay. extremely stable when you're doing
so
audio processing.
So that trumps just amazing
everything.
Quality of recording.
Yes.
So 32-bit, what you're saying is that the 32-bit version means that it's going to be just a lean, mean, super reliable machine. You don't have to worry about it. And if it were 64-bit, it might be more hiccupy.
I would say that since the 32-bit has been around longer, and not necessarily longer, and the software that's running on it, it's most likely the software running on it, Choice, mm-hmm. There's no reason to go for the other version.
Okay.
Mostly,
so you're not gaining anything
that's
by
right.
having double the bits.
One of the things you gain pretty substantially when you do more, when you do 64-bit operating system versus a 32, is the amount of memory you can access, mm-hmm. so the amount of RAM you can access. Mm-hmm. And with 32-bit, you can get up to 4 megs. 4 gigs. Oh, now I've lost my track of my memory. 4 gigs.
An amount.
Of RAM. Yeah. And that's more than enough to serve 4 or 5 streams of audio. Like, you don't need that, really. Okay. Now, the hard drive is actually a better question. SSD versus not.
Right.
I would argue that the reason why you'd want to use an SSD for an audio store is that, one, it has an... hard drives fail. SSDs don't fail as soon.
Just say, do you know what SSD
sure.
stands for?
Solid state drive.
Okay, so it's
not
no
a spinning
parts.
Platter. That's right. There's no hard drive that actually spins
and
around.
And therefore more reliable and less noise.
They are more expensive. They use less power. They're more reliable. They're extremely fast.
Okay.
So those things, the problem with them is that because they're expensive for size, for a music storage device, you wouldn't want them. Except that he's talking about putting his music on a network storage device. Mm-hmm. What do you say?
He's a music server computer to house a music library. Yeah.
Yeah, a network detached storage.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So what this means is it's another collection of hard drives potentially that all the music's on and it's available anywhere. So you could do that with SSDs if you've got the money and it would be beautiful and it would fail less. And I would argue that that's awesome.
Uh-huh.
If you've got unlimited funds, do it.
Yeah.
So there's my answer. How's that?
Sounds great to me. Hopefully it worked for John. I'll just assume that he can write us if he's got follow-up questions.
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right, very good.
All right, so we should start taking calls probably, don't you think?
That sounds pretty good. Shall I give out the number again? It's
sure.
I'm just going to do it. 800-655-5877. Call that number. Rick will answer the phone and get you in the queue. You know, there was kind of like an amazing bit of real-life sky scare happening. Where a meteor fell in Russia and glass broke everywhere. Everyone in the world got just glass shards in them.
Everyone in the world did.
Everyone over there. And there was various kinds of panic. And one thing that was that struck me is that there were quite a number of really good amateur videos of the meteor actually falling from the sky. And a weird number of them were from dashboard cameras. And now that I think about it, Lyle, I've seen other sort of YouTube bits over the past, I don't know, year or so, that are from Russian dashboard cameras. What is the deal with Russian dashboard cameras?
So we're talking
cameras?
About in cars, a camera that's aimed at the road ahead of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, we originally first started seeing these in police cars. We saw a lot of footage from police cars,
that's
right?
That's right.
Right,
yeah.
And then they became this thing that some people have. And I don't know anyone that has one. Do you?
No.
Right, but I don't know a lot of people in Russia. And you're right. They're all over Russia for some reason.
Russia, they're all about it. It's like a thing over there.
Yeah.
Is it just a fad?
You would think it's just a fad, but it's kind of an expensive fad. It actually comes down right down to politics. In Russia... it's really likely for a police officer to shake you down. And if you got a recording camera recording the conversation, it's less likely. Or if they shake you down too much, you can go to court and have proof.
And you've got proof.
And that's why they've got them, I think.
It's insurance against getting shaken down. Or...
It's about bad government.
It's about bad government.
Isn't it always?
Bad government. Really great YouTube videos.
Really great
As a
YouTube
result,
videos.
The world
Though
is
I
got to
say, if you start watching those, sometimes you see some horrible accidents.
I haven't really
fun.
Done deep digging.
But the asteroid footage is wonderful. We'll sync it up on epicgeekspeak.org.
Well, and let's be
show.
Clear, it was meteor.
I'm sorry.
The meteor that fell. The asteroid,
it was an asteroid at some
not
point.
Going to hit us. This was a chunk. Was
yes, a chunk. I'm sorry. Meteor.
Although it was a good size one. It was like 26 feet across or something.
So Miles is listening to the show live.
Oh, he is.
And he's giving us feedback. And he says, SSD is not more reliable, Lyle. Now, I'm going to argue with him. And since he can't respond, I win, which
Miles.
Is lovely. The issue with SSRIs.
Can you elaborate about why it's not?
Yeah, he says more vibration resistant, but rather than increasing bad sectors, it just dies without warning. Okay. So here's the trouble with SSD. The technology behind it, I would argue, is superior in a lot of ways to hard drives, in almost every way. Mm-hmm. But what's happening is there's a market for hard drives where people, the market is simply this. People want a new hard drive that's big enough and fast enough. Okay?
Yeah.
And they are willing to take some risk in the sense that they're not going to buy the stuff that's designed to be bulletproof because it's really expensive. Mm-hmm. So they're going to buy the cheaper brand SSD. Price is still going to be a point. Mm-hmm. So the normal consumer says, oh, SSD, I heard it's better. I want to buy it. Oh, look, it's more expensive, but not that much. Okay, I'll buy it. Mm-hmm. So the decision making on what goes into that hard drive, that SSD, is based on what a person's willing to purchase and their knowledge. And they're taking advantage of people. And that's why SSDs are not more reliable.
It's a marketing thing.
It is a marketing thing. So SSDs, solid-state drives, are in a electrical array of small storage cells of electrical charge. So imagine a screen on your kitchen door, an old screen, right? There's a whole bunch of holes. Yeah. And that's imagine now you fill those holes with a little bit of chalk or you remove them. That's a one or a zero. The chalk is actually electrons in a pool. So it's much more massive than you could possibly imagine. A gigabyte is something you can't actually comprehend with our tiny human brains, but okay. They're really big.
Okay.
And they're addressed by accessing each of the cell. Now, every time you read them, you have to rewrite them as well because I think that's true. Is that right? Yeah, I think you have
every
to rewrite.
Every time you reread them, you have to rewrite them?
Every time you read them, you have to write them. It's actually the same way our memories work. When you recall a memory, uh-huh. The actual stuff that stores in your brain gets destroyed, and you have to rewrite it.
Yeah.
So it's just a common way of...
Your memories can change over time. And
yeah. So, and if you think of it, we won't get into SSD that much. We'll go and we'll keep going. So, so the trick is that cell can actually hold a little bit of charge or not a lot of charge.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to sell a larger hard drive and you know that all that the consumer cares about is its SSD, well, then instead of storing a one or a zero in there, you can fill the square with half the amount of chalk or half the amount of electrons and still know that it's only a little bit of charge. This is a multi-layered, and I think that's what it's, I'm not sure what it's called, but it's like a multi-layered SSD. They're cheating.
Right.
And okay. That means that it's less robust.
Multi-layered is cheating.
Well, in the sense that instead of saying this one cell is either on or off, they're saying you could have four states in the cell. You could have a little bit of charge, a little bit more, and a little bit more than that. And that would be a representation of what's stored in there. So you're kind of doubling the amount of storage you can support on the drive. Now, additionally, to inject the electrons through there, it goes through a membrane, and that membrane over time gets damaged. Something like 10,000 writes. We've heard this a lot.
Okay, so you write a lot. If you have a piece of paper and you write on it in pencil,
and you erase
it. You can erase it, and you've done something to the surface of the paper.
Yes.
And if you keep rewriting, there will be permanent.
That's right.
Damage.
Now that damage permanency is it's not uniform. It's based on the material. It's very complicated. But the way you compensate for that is you store extra cells you do not use, and when one of the cells becomes troubling to write on, you use that extra space. So, really good SSD drives do not store multiple values per cell. Additionally, they have extra cells for you to store. Uh-huh. So, as it fails, it recovers, and it has an amazing ability to do that. Now, hard drives are the same way. They pushed it too much, and that's why they're unreliable. But the point is that it's not about the underlying technology. It's how it's implemented based off of price and based off of what consumer will do. So you want a better quality SSD drive.
Yeah.
I'll find an article for this and put it up on geekspeak.org so people can understand when they're buying SSD, it's important to buy the better one, even though it's going to cost more, because it will have the reliability and the wonderfulness that I would argue I like about them.
Okay, so it sounds like there's a couple factors there. There's what would make best functionality, and there's what company can sell easiest.
Yeah, absolutely. And that line is based on what the consumer is willing to do. And of course, we're talking tech, and so no one understands it.
Yeah.
And by the way, including me, like right now, if I need to buy an SSD, I'd have to do a whole bunch of research. And the only reason I can do that research is that I have a bit of understanding it. It's tricky. I'm not trying to say this is easy by any means. So.
Got it.
All right.
So if people are flummoxed, it's because it's flummoxing.
Yes. I would say that's exactly right.
Okay. That's the natural human reaction to a truly flummoxing thing.
Yes.
Got it. So we had a little more input from a totally different John, by the way, on the whole dash cams in Russia thing. Which is that his understanding was that people use them to reduce their car insurance cost.
You can do that in the States, yeah. I don't know about in Russia.
I don't know how that works. Like, so, why would that reduce your insurance cost?
So, you know, the insurance company is all about, they want to give you a good deal. Uh-huh. And the way they do that is they take an average of every person out there and in your zip code or whatever with your kind of car and your kind of age and assess how likely it is it for you to get in an accident. Okay.
Okay.
But what if you claim, hey, no, I'm a really good driver. I'm a really good driver.
Okay.
So if you're recording yourself all the time and an accident does occur and you say, I'm a good driver, they can look at the footage and decide to deny you based on your performance. Right? So it basically gives them an ability to go, oh, I really was. It also, of course, is if it wasn't your fault, you have a recording and it wasn't your fault.
Got
right?
It.
Someone pulls right in front of you, slams on your brake, then there's the safety there too.
Right.
So there's really good reasons to have it in the States, even though we can generally trust we're not going to get shooken down by the police.
How much are they? How do I get them?
I know. Let's go.
All right. Now I'm all curious about dashboard cams. And we've got Joseph, who's got he feels unnecessarily sheepish about this question. He says that he's geek challenged and says, look, I just want to know, how do I change the information in autofill when it comes up every time I need to fill out a form? I have a Mac, he says.
Oh.
How do you deal with autofill?
Okay. So on a Mac, it's not likely for a user to understand that there's actually an optional way to click things. This is a right button, mouse button that all the PC people know.
Yeah.
But Mac people don't always know that it exists. So on a Mac, if you take in a field, you can actually control click. You push the control button. That's the
it's
right on the bottom left.
Click. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You click the cell that's just auto-filled. Normally it's like yellow highlighted when you fill it in.
Yeah.
Click that cell and you'll actually get a menu item. And in that menu item, and you can do that all over your computer. You can do a control click or a right click. And it'll give you a contextual menu is what it's called. It's a menu that's based on where you've clicked. And you can then at that point choose to, and I don't know what it's called, but the autofill settings
some
will
kind
be there.
An option thing mm-hmm. or something.
And change the reason I'm not saying go into the settings and the settings and the settings, it actually depends on the browser.
Yeah.
Firefox, Safari, and but all of them should give you the ability to do it right there with a control click or context click.
Okay.
Context menu.
So for Macs, it's control click, and for the PC people, it's just right click.
Right click on a PC, yeah. You just add extra buttons, more choices. I know Mac users aren't always used to that.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
I say as a Mac user.
Right. So what do we got?
Well, you know what we got? We got to do one thing, this little station business. And when we get back, we'll have figured out some calls and take some calls. And also, we could talk a little bit about heat and burns. I had a great conversation with my daughters this morning about that. Hi, Bonnie. Oh, my gosh, I didn't turn you back on.
Yeah, it's okay. I come pre-equipped. So it's spring. We're talking about all kinds of dashboards. And you had something in mind, some analog sort of piece of geekery wonderfulness.
Completely. You know,
I find... about burns?
What reminded me of this, as I'm describing how SSDs work, I start going to these metaphors of screens and chalk inside cells. And I realize that continually people ask me questions and I try to take the answer to a level that I think will communicate well, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. That's one of the jobs here. Mm-hmm. And I do that with my kids too. And on and what happens sometimes, of course, is someone asks a question and you go, I don't actually think I know how to answer that question.
Yeah.
So my kids did this morning. And I always thought, oh, I'll talk about this on the radio and I'll look it up and figure it out and then I'll know. And of course, in the ride in, I figured it out in my mind without looking it up, which was like, oh yeah, that's kind of one of the things you do. But the question was quite simple. We got in this conversation about burns. My daughter's like, hey, why can my brother put his finger through a flame and he doesn't get burned? Does he have superpowers? I thought, yeah, well, he does. But what's happening there is that burn is actually heating up. So the question is, how far do you go with a 7-year-old asking that question? Do I talk about, well, there's chemical bonds, and when you heat up the chemical bond, it gives enough energy to do it to modify itself. We call that oxidation. Another thing we call that is burning, and that's what happens with the wood. You know, I could have just gone off on this tangent.
Like really
she glazed over and never asked me a question again.
Yeah,
right?
So, yeah. I've been there too myself.
So I said, okay, well, burns are about heat and time, and doing both of those the same, doing too much time with enough heat, and so you can... It sounded better this morning, so let me start again. If you take a hot cup of tea, you've poured a hot cup of tea,
yeah,
and you pick it up and your hand's going, ow, this could hurt me.
Yeah.
At some point in the near future, you know, as adults, we know we have to put it down because we're going to get burned.
Right.
Even with just a cup of tea. Uh-huh. We definitely wouldn't want to put it in our mouth. We're not ready yet.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of understanding that even though it's hot enough to burn us, we can touch it and we just have to put it down quick enough.
Right.
Right. So I explained that a cup of tea is, you know, 30 seconds or so. You can walk from the room.
Enough
right?
heat with enough period of time and you got yourself.
And then I mentioned sunburns. And Maggie said 20 minutes. Okay. So 20 minutes of time in the sun will burn you.
Yeah.
And then as things get hotter, you get less and less time until you finally, you have something like an iron where you can touch it extremely fast.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's
you
pretty
have
hot.
A third degree burn and stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
In describing this, I mentioned something about hot grease. And Maggie said, oh, tell them about hot grease. Okay, so grease and water, don't, if you have a grease fire. So then we got in this whole discussion about grease fires.
Yeah, water is not the way to put out a grease fire.
Don't put it, yeah. So why? Well, what's going on? I said, well, when you throw water on grease, first off, it kind of explodes.
Yeah.
And I thought in my mind, I don't know why that's happening. Okay, that's the part I didn't know for a second.
Okay.
Until my drive-in. So, but I went on and said, the point is that you need to get the oxygen away from it. So you need to put something on it. That's why we have blankets or, and I pulled out the fire extinguisher and I taught them how to use a fire extinguisher. Okay. Which actually our fire extinguisher would work for a grease fire. It's a different type. But anyway,
all right.
The point being that I had something in my mind there I didn't have an answer for.
Yeah.
And so on the right end, Bonnie, do you know why it is that when you're dealing with like cooking delicious bacon, if water drips in the pan, there seems to be a splattering of grease and some bang sound, like a sound.
Well, the oil and water don't mix. I know that.
Mm-hmm. And that's what happened to me too. I was like, oh, that must be the train, and I let it fade away.
Uh-huh.
But go on.
And then, let's see, water also is a different temperature, so it tries to boil.
Yes.
And it moves things.
Yes.
And the things it moves are grease, and then they get on your clothes and your skin.
So what you've just described is the water drop. When water heats up and turns into a gas, it expands extremely fast. It's very quick. Right?
Okay, yeah.
Steam engine power is basically using this concept. You pressurize water, you heat it up, and then it gets really highly pressurized. If you do that extremely fast, it's actually kind of like an explosion, right? Mm-hmm. So when a drop of water hits that grease, it expands extremely rapidly, and in that extreme rapid explosion of turning into gas, it throws grease. Okay. And that's actually what's happening with the...
There we go.
Hope the kids are listening.
Oh, shoo. Figured it out. All right.
Let's take some calls, shall we?
Yeah, we've got a minute left, right? who's talking to us?
Have I spoken enough today? I think I have.
Yeah, you've spoken enough today.
Elizabeth from SoCal, welcome to Geek Speak. Thank you so much for joining us, Elizabeth. What's your question today?
Okay. I'm as non-geek as you can get. However, I like your show because you talk a lot about science. I just know now how to talk to my grandkids about fire, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So way back when you guys were young, I was up at the university using Unix. So I did know something about computers. However, I hurt my back 25 years ago, and it's very painful to use a computer. So my friends have been talking to me, and I'm trying to figure out, do I get an iPad? Do I get an iPhone? Do I get a netbook? My injury involves my using my right hand.
So,
okay. So I'm trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah,
what do I need?
Yeah. So you have like a carpal tunnel syndrome or something like that where typing's painful mouse control?
No, I hurt my scapula.
Okay.
No, I hurt my scapula.
Right.
They've cut off the nerves to 7 vertebrae.
Okay. Oh. So using your right arm for detailed work is not something that's going to be enjoyable for you.
Right.
Right.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
How's your left hand?
If I use it too much, then then my other scapula will bother me.
Yeah, stay off the computers.
My injury is like that, you know, T7 to T10.
Yeah,
you know, in there.
Hey,
so
I know that area of the spine.
This just a thing where having something that's more voice interactive than touch interactive
it
is really
like
going to help her out?
Yeah, and the iOS devices actually do have built-in voice command stuff. The other trick would be. So I would, one way, if you had perfectly functioning left hand, you had no problems with it, you could get like an iPhone and use the typing only with your left thumb. But I think over time that would be problematic. And the other trouble with it is that you need more minute detailed touch to use the iPhone because it's smaller. So a large device is better.
Right.
But I got to say, I think at this point what you should do is not invest in something, but do some research. Go and find someone that has one. Say, hey, can I borrow it for the night? And they will cry and tear up and then they'll let you do it. And then they'll want it back the next day.
Save my baby.
I would try it because it's really about your body positioning and such. I think a laptop like a MacBook or something, not a good idea because it's going to be right back to the keyboard. And the keyboard, you just have to do it the way you have to do it. Like there's no, if you're planning on doing a lot of writing, switch to voice controlled. And I think the iPad or an iPhone might actually work for you. Yeah, that's a tricky. That's tricky.
Do they have good voice software for the pads and things?
Not for long-term writing. They do. Dragon Naturally Speaking is available, and there are software solutions there, especially if you use a microphone, like the buds that come with it. Again, I'd test it.
Okay. I was iPad, and I was wondering, what do I need to know to buy a used iPad?
we're coming into the show, unfortunately, as I hear the music coming in. I think the answer to that question, it varies a bit. Because what you need, I would suggest if you're going to use dictation software, to get at least an iPad 2. Other than that, you're good. Any version of iPad 2 that's working would probably be okay for you. And also, I want to recommend, Elizabeth, that since you're in SoCal, go to Cabrillo. They've got a wonderful computer lab that's designed for people that are having issues with body, like, you know, problems with their body and using computers. And they would have a lot of resources in that space. Thank you so much for the call. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. I'm Lyle Trox on the air with Bonnie Jean Premch. Thanks for being here.